Okay, this is part two of our interview with Will Aracon, who made the Pixel I'm Not Beer, and this is January 26, 2009. Now, Will, I re-listened to the first interview, and some points came up. First thing, since Scott forgot to mute the his end of the triangle here, there was a lot of noise in the first half of the interview. But it struck me so appropriately, and how appropriate it was, that you're a noise guy. Even when I call your phone, there's noise, irritating noise.
Right.
In I'm Not Beer, there's all this irritating noise as an undercurrent, right?
Right, definitely.
So the Android meme set it up that your interview would have all this noise underneath it. Okay? What do you think of that, man?
Yeah, I'm into it.
Yeah. The noise in the first, I have a note here. The noise in the first half is a reflection of your style of video.
Right, definitely. I was obscuring the conversation and all that.
Yeah. And the second point, I said that I was describing to you how Rai created the first separateness, was the first separateness, and I realized, re-listening to the interview, that paranoia began the phenomenon of being confused and paranoid.
There it is there.
Yeah, the title of your paper, right?
Right.
He's the original confused and paranoid, or it, whatever I is, was the first emotion of confusion and paranoia, and ran off and created all these dimensions, hiding from the plane of heaven or the plane of essence. Okay, and Rai creates an island, which is this dimension, a madhouse, an area cut off from spirit, on the surface anyways. So it's amazing. You mimed the action of Rai, or at least the meaning of Rai. You went and investigated the island, and you came out of it deciding the theme was confused and paranoid, miming Rai. Okay. The next thing is, you mentioned Cooper's Glen as your home for a while, which was the old Evergreen State College dorm or something?
Yeah,
or married quarters. And it's now a ghetto. Well,
yeah, it's kind of a ghetto.
Yeah, and then there was another, Cooper's Glen and Cooper something else, Cooper Hall. Was there another?
The Cooper Point Journal was the newspaper.
Yeah, the Cooper Point Journal. All this reflects Dale Cooper of Twin Peaks.
Right.
Have you ever seen Twin Peaks?
Yeah, I've seen every episode.
Oh, okay.
I own the first two seasons, actually. I was watching them the other night.
Oh, okay. There's the timeliness of it. And I've been making a big issue when I'm on CKLN every Sunday. I make a big issue out of someone called Dave Cooper. And Greg keeps thinking I mean Dale Cooper. So I've been talking about Dale Cooper lately on Sundays on the radio. But what as I thought about it, I thought, well, Olympia, it's a little bigger than Twin Peaks, but you actually think of it, Olympia is the atmosphere, the geography of Twin Peaks.
Right, and actually, Kurt Cobain once was quoted saying that that Olympia is like Twin Peaks, but not as exciting.
Wow, that's amazing, because, well, was he involved with Olympia?
Yeah, definitely.
You mean he didn't come from there?
No, but well, Courtney Love went to school there.
In Olympia?
Yeah, at Evergreen. She dropped out.
She went to Evergreen? Holy cow.
And then he had a K Records tattoo, which is based out of Olympia. Like, he was living there and all that.
Because he was involved with her, maybe?
Yeah, and just, you know, it's like, it's a cool place to be. In theory, there's a lot of music there. There's a lot of happening. There's the whole Riot Girl thing going on. There's a lot of stuff there at that point in time.
Very interesting. So, some of the Twin Peaks vibe pits, the Twin Peaks vibe fits, and you got this Cooper's Glen, which is the old
right.
Get now a ghetto. Okay, the other note is that you have. I used to talk about 20 years. When is this? 80, 89, 90. Yeah, 20 years ago, I used to talk about the battle between the Evergreens and cosmic awareness, and I haven't thought of the Evergreens to the degree that Worcester was right, that cosmic awareness moved on to Michael Blake Reed, who channeled the Evergreens, and the Evergreens were very different from cosmic awareness in what they said in a lot of ways. So I used to consider the Evergreens as the Android meme replay of the first nature channeling through Dave Worcester. And so the Evergreens being as they were an archive. You could find out about anything that ever happened here in any field. Very particular scientific knowledge, historical knowledge, mathematical knowledge, artistic knowledge, the Evergreens had it. It was like the internet, like a huge archive. Cosmic awareness wasn't that precise. So that you have the Evergreens being the Android meme version. So a subset of Evergreens versus Cosmic Awareness is Evergreen State College versus Matt Groening. And The Simpsons is the ultimate Android meme animated presentation of whatever counterculture themes that Wurster and Zappa and all these guys were presenting. It was the counterculture distilled. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so, so The Simpsons is the competition, the desire for some kind of human scale versus the Android meme. And so that's mined by Matt being eventually pissed off at Evergreen State College, if that's true. Now, on the Cosmic Awareness side, you have Avaton, or Winston Turnbull, against Dave Wurster. And Wurster, if you accept him as being the natural medium, and then Avaton makes Paul Shockley a more acceptable paranoid and confused medium, at least a lot of the beast and conspiracy information that became popular in the 90s, it really all came first out of Paul Shockley's readings in the mid-70s, late-70s. He was the first to talk about Dr. Beter, talked about LaRue stuff, about everything. And so that confused and paranoid element. So if Paul Shockley is the Android meme replay of Dave Wurster, just as Michael Blake Reed is the Android meme replay of Dave Wurster, you have sub-battles going on here. So Avaton versus Wurster over in the Cosmic Awareness Squadron, Evergreen State College against Matt Groening in the other quadrant, but overall is the Evergreens battle versus Cosmic Awareness. Now, bring it back to you, both Evergreens and Cosmic Awareness did not want to make people paranoid. Paul Shockley made people more paranoid than Wurster or Ralph Doobie. But the Evergreens definitely said the tragedies that people are projecting aren't going to be as bad as everybody either wants or fears. So Evergreens and Cosmic Awareness, both of them were playing down the confused and paranoid cultural atmosphere. Now we come to you. You're the anthropologist of disaster. Your safe harbor TV is these guys, victims of disaster, people hanging out under bridges and you know, the underbelly, just barely scraping by, right?
I suppose so.
Yeah, the kind of unemployed or whatever they are, rootless. People not functioning, well-adjusted to the Android meme and being functioning citizens. All those well-functioning citizens now got nailed through the collapse of Wall Street. They were set up, too, in the long run. So now they're all homeless, too. But you, as an anthropologist of disaster, leave San Francisco and look for a safe haven, safe harbor. I never thought of this. Safe harbor away from post 911 San Francisco, right?
Right.
So you got this cloud of disaster over you. So you run to Ashland. That doesn't work. And then you end up in Olympia, but you're under the threat of Mount Rainier. No safe harbor. So actually, is Safe Harbor TV, is that what you guys were thinking of when you named your show that?
No, Safe Harbor TV, it actually comes from the time slot. It's after 10 a.m. and before 6 a.m., or after 10 p.m. and before 6 a.m., when you're allowed to show anything not deemed obscene by the Supreme Court.
Oh, is that like I think I've heard that said on WBAI. You mean that's the technical term from the FCC? It's a safe harbor?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So there's no restrictions. So you're an anthropologist of disaster, and you are trying to avoid disaster, but you keep running into it, and you go to Dana Beale, and that's a disaster zone in some ways, a constant disaster crisis there to maintain their their beachhead into what, I don't know. But you know what I mean? It's a bit under, a bit tense there, and it's an island. So you're miming the whole effect of Rai. The Rai's created this disaster zone called Earth, or this dimension, and we're all trying to have a safe harbor within this disaster's place, and you're running around analyzing it, and you're up against the Evergreens and Cosmic Awareness, who are playing down the disaster meme, all right? You don't know that, and you're more under, you don't know it, you're under the sway of the more disastrous part of Cosmic Awareness, the Paul Shockley phase, the Android meme phase. So you, as a young person, are battling the Android meme of all this stuff. And Shockley tries to play down the disaster, but he gets attention by hooking up a lot of disaster scenarios. So so it's appropriate that you document in I'm Not Beer the disaster of the Android meme, the collapse of the Android meme, or at least when it reigns supreme and caused disasters, and then it's an inventory, your pixel, of its annihilation. And let's see. So you're celebrating the annihilation of the Android meme, but you're unaware of what caused it, where it came from, and who the players are. You're just channeling it. You didn't know who Rai was. So all of these factors, the noise in our first part of the interview last time, the confused and paranoid paper, Cooper's Glen, Evergreens versus Cosmic Awareness, subset Evergreens State College versus Simpsons and Matt Groening, and you, the anthropologist of disaster, all converge in the pixel. And I think that's pretty neat. I get that from re-listening to it. So, unless you have something to say, let's move to Scott. And I'm reviewing all this just to remind people, if they haven't heard the first one, this is basically what we end up talking about. Though we're going to get into more the hidden synchronicities of Safe Harbor TV here, maybe. Okay.
Okay. Well, here's one thing from the last one. I was re-listening to it also. And at one point you were talking about a video that struck you in Safe Harbor, the episodes I mailed you.
Yes, and I would just say this. The guy who's suing the beer people or something, whoever it was, he's like a Twin Peaks character.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. He's kind of wild. Okay. The other one, you're talking about the one with the fingernails.
Yeah.
And I said something, I didn't know what it was, and then I said something, perhaps. It was actually made by a guy named Zeben, perhaps. So there's a little synchronicity.
Oh, you said the word perhaps when we were trying to determine whether it was a fingernails guy that you knew or not.
Yeah.
And then you're thinking of it later, you remember who it is, what the video is I'm thinking of, and you say, that was not made by you, it was made by someone else.
Yeah, it was made, me and this other guy made it. He shot it all.
His last name is perhaps? His last
name? Yeah, he goes by the name perhaps, yeah.
You know, that's interesting about perhaps, because I remember in 1968, Lido Rescue did an article for the East Village Other, and she commented on the State of the Union address that she thought that Zappa's Uncle Meat album was the State of the Union address. And it came out in the spring of 69, so 40 years ago. And she said the message was maybe, dot, 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 perhaps. So I always thought that a message of something, the big artistic statement, it's almost like fitting his wig. Maybe, perhaps. So when I was looking at your Safe Harbor stuff, I saw the credit to perhaps, I think. You know what I mean? I think it's listed there. I saw it. I always think when I see the word perhaps, I think of the Zappa or Lee Liskey saying, maybe, perhaps. So that really sums up your generation. You guys live such an ambivalent, ambiguous reality, no reality, semi-virtual and everything, you guys live a world of maybe, perhaps, right?
Yeah, possibly, I guess.
Your generation. And we found the kid who picked up on this, your friend, perhaps. Okay, I'm glad you thought of that. A nod to perhaps, or giving himself the correct name.
You're reminding me of Robert Anton Wilson's website, Maybe Logic.
Yes, right, yeah. Whenever I saw that, I thought, well, maybe he got that from Frank. Okay, perhaps. So And did you guys hear that the guy who named Generation X, Douglas Coupland, you hear about it? He's doing a biography of McLuhan.
I didn't hear that.
Yeah, and he lives right up there, you guys, in Vancouver. Anyways, he named the people born after 1965 the Generation X. And then after that, depends where you cut off Generation X. I call the next generation the Morpheus generation, but they're born around 1990. I don't know about you guys born in the early 80s, but you guys would be the perhaps generation. So you tell Mr. Perhaps he should market his name. He should put a stamp on your age group.
Yeah.
Is he around still?
Yeah, he's in Portland, I think, these days.
Okay, well, that's where Scott is. We're getting taped in Portland. Okay, go ahead, Scott. What are your questions? What do you make of all this?
Well, a couple of things just came up for me as I was listening to you do your review, Bob. One of which is that when I re-listened to the talk, I also thought that the noise was appropriate and was just perfect. And also, you may not have picked up on it. It may not be significant to you, but it is to me. If you go back, I was editing a bit of audio about someone who was associated with E.J. Gold. And the woman mentions E.J. Gold's name in the background in that noise. Now, E.J. Gold wrote the American Book of the Dead, which was a translation of the Tibetan Book of the Dead for the Western psyche. And the Tibetan Book of the Dead is all about surviving the ambushes of the creation that Ra'i made for us to hide out in, and getting back through to the clear light, or back to essence.
After you die.
After you die, yeah.
Yeah.
So,
didn't E.J. Gold, his book is more of the externalized bardos in life, right?
Well, it the more that you study it, the more it begins, you notice that it interpolates into your daily physical life, but it also is of value. You read it for someone when they die, because the physical life, the sensory matrix begins to come undone, and you begin to you have the opportunity to return to essence if you don't get freaked out by all the shocking ambushes that occur within the labyrinth on the way back to essence.
Right, so he translated the Book of Dead and put it into English or into American cultural terms or something.
Exactly, yeah. He used Western archetypes as opposed to the Tibetan archetypes, which, you know, have to do with all of the weird Tibetan imagery.
Right, and actually Twin Peaks can be looked at as the journey of Dale Cooper through the Bardos, you know, encountering Bob and all that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so
The second interesting thing is
well, about this E.J. Gold, so you're saying it's appropriate that he's mentioned.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was wondering what all the noise, like, what are the sounds? It sounds like a factory.
Yeah, I was editing a piece of audio that I clipped off the internet as a woman who is an associate of E.J. Gold, and it just that because my the mute was off on my phone, the way that it has this kind of thing where the microphone listens and then turns off and then listens and turns off depending on how loud the volume is, and so it was. Just coming through weird, that's all.
Okay, so, yeah, it sounded like an Eraserhead factory, you know, like in the movie Eraserhead.
Right.
Okay, so you're just saying that E.J. Gold has Twin Peaks, but it fits, you think?
I think it fits everything you're talking about with respect to the Ralph Doobie and his paranoid conspiracy around the manifestation of Ra'i, and then the Evergreens and the Worcester suggesting that Ra'i's returning to essence.
Right, and Doobie was the first paranoid, and then Shockley carried it off later after Worcester. And there's another factor. I see that Will's generation, they have to go, and this is what my chart refers to, even though it's dead, all the kids have to go through all these media bardos. They got to do books, they got to do animation, they got to do film, they got to TV, they got to go through all these old environments or after images of the Android meme to establish an identity. Right, Will?
Yeah, definitely. I would agree to that.
Yeah. Okay, so that...
And then here's the next really cool thing. I didn't think about it till just now, but, you know, Bob, I've heard just about everything that we can find of where you're speaking, and it's been posted to the internet, from old CKLN shows to, you know, I'll just, you know, everything.
Yeah.
I missed one program that's been out there for a few years, and I just heard it this week after listening to, after reviewing last week's, your discussion with Will, and that's your thing that you did with 8-bit, where you spend about a half an hour or so going into the phenomena of Kigi and Hexbody.
Yeah.
And that was perfect because it kind of got me into that part of Will's vibe, you know, where you got into the underbelly of culture, and also the what you've been pointing to this evening, Bob, in terms of the chaos of Will's generation. So it was just interesting. I thought it was perfect that I got to hear that for the first time immediately after listening to Will.
Yeah, because Will, what Kigi and Hexbody, the same person as a young guy. He was born in 1983 in March. What month are you born?
September.
Okay, so Kigi is 6 months older than you, and he didn't like college. He became homeless, and he was on 5-Body for years. You know, totally nuts. Or pretending to be nuts anyways. He used to always talk about my chart, use the chart to interpret every little thing he did. He was a prostitute in Seattle. He did drugs. He did everything. He also joined the LaRouche movement. I told him, hey, you've got to develop your left hemisphere. So he joined the LaRouche movement for a while. And he was all over the place. But at the time, the Virginia Tech... Oh, did you hear, guys, here that someone got their head cut off at Virginia Tech the other day?
No, I didn't hear that.
Yeah, God, what's the circumstances?
Okay, you know, Virginia Tech, when was that? That was May 2007. March, April, May 2007. No, it was April, I think. The student shoots, you know, 30 people or something, right? You know, we know what we're talking about. Well, it was on the news yesterday that a Chinese female student came over, befriended this other maybe Chinese, Korean guy or something. He was older, he was a student. And she was only there like that 10 days, and then all of a sudden they're sitting in the cafeteria, and her maybe boyfriend, mentor, pulls out a knife and cuts her head off. Right there in the cafeteria. And the cops came immediately, campus police or whatever, and the guy who did it was holding her head, gave it to the cops. Yeah, and I didn't see much coverage of that. But the interesting thing is that when that was happening, Kigi, who gets a lot of, he thinks he's getting Xenocrony. He's getting synchronicity with me and with the Five Bodies website, which is the only website that has synchronicity going on among the participants, and that's an interesting phenomenon. He thinks it's Xenocrony all around him. So he decided that he was channeling or somehow involved with that guy in April 2007, that they were simpatico or something. And he was in Portland at that time, in the underbelly of Portland near Scott, and I was telling Scott, I was telling this other guy who was interviewing me in New York, that Scott, who I was doing these dialogues with, that Kigi wanted to listen to, he was hanging out homeless in Portland, and maybe was going to nail Scott if he could find him, because Kigi was very mad at me. But you're right, Scott, he's exactly the kind of guy that you've been filming or talking about hanging out with, Will. So Scott, he was meant to miss and not hear that thing until it really had resonance right after the Will stuff. Right, Scott? That's what you're saying.
That's what it felt like to me.
Okay, anything else?
Actually, Will, when Jerry gave you the assignment, he gave you the footage that he had done interviewing Bob. What did you know about Bob prior to that?
I didn't know much about Bob prior to that, other than a few things that I'd read online about his father. And
but why would you have even read that online? Why would you even know that?
Oh, from other Pixel movies. I think maybe from, like, an Eli Elliott movie.
Right, just and through Jerry. Through Jerry you would hear about me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why did you accept that project from Jerry?
At the time, I was having a kind of like a creative problem, and
you had nothing to do.
Couldn't
think of anything.
Mm. Yeah, well, not even think. I just couldn't execute anything. I could think of a lot of stuff.
Why couldn't you execute?
Just like mental blocks.
But you had the equipment.
Yeah, I had the equipment. I didn't really have the time necessarily.
Yeah.
But it was, I don't know, something about it just wasn't working out.
What equipment?
And so then when he gave me that, I took it because I like Jerry, and then I almost didn't do it a couple times. I almost just gave up on it, but instead I continued.
Well, when you saw the footage, you decided that the footage didn't give you anything to work with or something, right?
Yeah, the original footage that you gave me, it didn't fit in with my idea of what it was going to be.
Okay, did it fit in with, did you see how we were playing off of the actual movie, I'm Not There?
Yeah, I did. But for whatever reason, it just didn't feel right to me.
Okay, so
like
then
someone else could have made that, but not me, necessarily.
So you had a personal, unique plan. You were thinking of the Todd Haynes movie in some way, right?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, but you wanted to do it differently. Or just, you don't know what you want to do. I don't know. So you were trying to think of something, and you couldn't come up with anything? And you got frustrated every now and then?
No, I mean, I could come up with things. I think it was the just like you yourself, like everything that you talk about, was a little foreign to me at the time.
Yeah, you didn't know what I was talking about. What?
I mean, I kind of did, and I kind of didn't.
In other words, yeah, you couldn't get a handle on whatever Jerry thought should be understood about me.
Right, like, I mean, I knew about Lyndon Liverpool.
Yeah.
And I knew about McLuhan, but I didn't know about Kroger or William Irwin Thompson. I knew about Bob Dawes, like, the sub-junior thing from when I was little. At different points in my life, ran into the sub-genii or whatever.
Yeah.
But for whatever reason, the footage just didn't really resonant. I think it was like that, because you shot it all in the same location, pretty much, or in two locations.
No, right there in Jerry's backyard.
And then you shot other stuff later on that night inside.
Oh, okay. I forgot about that.
Pleasure.
I don't know. Okay, I don't know about that.
So there just wasn't enough variation in the background. So I decided to represent what you're talking about via images.
Right, so but you were looking, you started to read more of my stuff, and when you saw the chart, that gave you an idea.
And actually, I think I had signed on to Five Bodied about a year before I got that project.
Were you watching? Did you read any of it?
Yeah. Back when I was still in Olympia, I think, when I saw the DEFCON Bob.
Right.
Or the movie DEFCON Bob. I think it was from that I found out about Five Bodies and signed on to that, and didn't really realize at the time that you were connected to Jerry.
Right.
That you were more connected to Eli.
Right. And that means you, if you looked at the chat line, which was called Being Five Bodied, you would have seen posts by X-Body.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure that I did. Because he wrote on the Tiny Note chart.
A lot. A lot he wrote about it. We're not talking about,
like, on the actual post. Right, like in the charts archive, there's a bunch of stuff that he wrote with like color and all that.
Well, that could be Monsquaz. Monsquaz is the guy who writes the technical correct interpretation, so to speak, of it. He lays down the definitions of it based on what he's heard me say. But Hexbody would post, and somebody would raise a topic, and Hexbody said, "Well, I'm over in the fucking Thompson quadrant. I can't stand the Croker quadrant. I hate the McLuhan quadrant. I'm in the Thompson quadrant." And then he rant on about lesbians or something within the context of the Thompson quadrant and how he was looking for a girlfriend on the internet, and the last one dumped him. You know what I mean? He put this personal angst in the middle of using jargon from the charts. Did you remember seeing any posts like that?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. So it's even more connected to you, Scott. The guy who made this pixel knew X-Body.
Mm-hmm. And did you know Jerry when you saw the DEF CON Bob? And you said, but you said you didn't know that Jerry and Bob were connected?
Yeah. I did know Jerry. I mean, I think I sort of knew that Jerry and Bob were connected because when I was reading about Jerry online, I saw Bob's name come up a couple times.
Yeah.
But you thought it was more like it.
You thought it was more connected to Eli.
Yeah.
Now, okay, so the... Go on, Scott. Okay.
So you stumbled onto Bob independently through the DEF CON Bob video?
No, through Jerry. But just sort of because Jerry...
I stumbled on Eli through Jerry. And then kind of Bob through Eli. But also through Jerry.
About the same time. Yeah, you when you got to know Jerry, my name came up, and eventually you looked into my name.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, a couple of things I'm curious about, but before I go into it, I'd like to ask you what your opinion of LaRouche was at that point in time. Last week you mentioned that when you encountered the LaRouche people on the street, they seemed a little wacky and manipulative, and I got the impression that you might not have a lot of sympathy for LaRouche and his whole gestalt.
Well, a friend of mine actually he let some of the LaRouche fellows live at his house in Eugene for a few months, and then and then went crazy soon thereafter. Actually, went totally schizophrenic
after the LaRouches left.
Yeah, and started fighting them. he let them live there, but they had to fight him every night outside.
You mean they would argue?
No, I think fight them.
Well, why? That meant he was already crazy. He let them live there, but then he would fight them?
Yeah, I think it was kind of in response to what they were talking about. Eventually it turned into them fighting.
In other words, he might have liked them on the surface level, and then he found out more about them, and he got pissed off.
I think he was interested in them, because he let all sorts of people live with him.
Okay.
And he was always a little weird, but around that time he was bent over the edge, I'd say.
How old is he?
He's my age.
Oh, okay.
He's 25.
Okay, so that is something you know about. You know that experience.
Yeah, and then I encountered the LaRouche people afterwards, the same ones, in Olympia. And I mentioned Peter to them, and they're like, oh, well, Peter's crazy. And then I kind of got into an argument with them.
Ah, you did.
Then I knew about them from the Yippies, and that they didn't like them.
Right. Did you? Are you saying your friend Peter lived in Olympia?
No, he lived in Eugene, and he lived in the Bay Area.
Oh, okay. And these guys in Olympia knew of.
They stayed with Peter in Eugene. They were the same ones that he would fight.
And they were now up in Olympia, or when you saw them.
Yeah, because they make the loop or whatever
right.
They do. And I also thought that they were kind of the scrappiest bunch of political activists that I've ever. They were missing teeth. And scars on their faces and all that.
Yeah, since LaRouche is about rejuvenating industrial hardware and machinery. What's it called? Rotating machinery. You forget the kind of machine that he's always talking about. We have to have more developments in a certain kind of rotating machinery. And so they're working class. It's a thought structure for working class. You know what I mean?
They're like street fighters.
Yeah, street fighters. And that kind of mentality would be attracted to LaRouche.
Yeah.
Whereas the aesthetic mentality that you grew up, that environment you grew up in, is attracted to the Evergreens, to the Evergreens College kind of atmosphere.
Right.
I mean, you're more software than hardware. Those guys are hardware guys, right?
I don't know. I think I've been hardware, too, at different stages. But yeah, I'd say that they're definitely hardware guys.
Yeah, and I've met you. You're not a scrappy looking person.
Oh well, thank you.
Yeah, you're not. You're a delicate person, more delicate skinned kind of person. Okay.
Okay.
Okay, Scott, go ahead.
Yeah. Did you develop a personal bias in terms of the LaRouche philosophy, where you felt either attracted or repelled, or did you consider yourself more just sort of observing and not really taking sides?
Yeah, I'd say observing and not taking sides.
Mm-hmm. So when you saw LaRouche in Bob's chart, as you already knew that a lot of LaRouchians were kind of crazy, but you didn't. That didn't like turn you off to Bob's chart. Go, oh, this guy's into LaRouche. I don't even want to look at his chart.
No, definitely not. But I have heard that from other people that the LaRouche bit kind of turns them off.
Yeah, it turns me off. It turns them off of me. You're saying.
Yeah.
They don't. They think it's like McLuhan used to say. If I talk about something, people think I'm for it. They think that my chart is a projection of me. It's not. It's a map of the American Android meme.
Right. They think LaRouche is a projection of your personal politics.
Yeah, and that I like him because I put him in there.
Well, oh. you may like things about LaRouche, but he doesn't represent your personal politics.
No, and he represents an era, an ERA, or ERROR, an era of American history. He wants to go back to the FDR period. He represents the industrial phase of the chart, hardware. He's not. He has no clue about the McLuhan software perceptions, you know? And me and Bob Marshall have interviewed LaRouche several times, and we bring in McLuhan stuff, and you can tell. He's savvy up to a point, but then he has no clue. So
he may have a clue, but he may see it as being an infectious virus that he needs to fight against.
Yes, back in 1980, the one time I saw his people, and they'd always be spouting anyways, basically what he was saying, is they said McLuhan was a media fetishist. And that's a good way. If you're into wanting to get away from the post-industrial society and get back to real hardware and make America a producer again, if it was possible, and McLuhan was not right, if McLuhan's right, it's not possible, then McLuhan is a guy who fetishizes software media and distracts everybody from getting back to work and making better technology, better hardware technologies, and getting to the moon, right? So that's the hardware guys, and that whole sensibility came in with the radio era. So if you look on the chart, it's 1840 to 1900, replayed from 47 to 57 within the Android meme, and that's the McCarthy era, and of course, LaRouche is considered a McCarthy kind of a politician, a scapegoating, finger-pointing guy, and that's the whole industrial structure that represents, up till recently, the white trash or the poor working class just getting a beachhead in universities in the 70s and 80s where they could get better jobs right when the whole structure was going to be pulled out from under them because the hardware was moving offshore. And LaRouche feeds off that grievance.
Mm-hmm.
You follow what I'm saying?
Mm.
Yeah.
So LaRouche is that represents as an icon that meme, that desire, that memory in the chart. That's why he's an ant. He's a working ant. He's not the electric bee.
So when you accepted the project from Jerry, you knew something about LaRouchians firsthand because you encountered them on the street. And what did you know about McLuhan?
McLuhan, I knew about, just about as much as maybe a little bit more than most people, which is not very much.
Because you had it in your school course?
Yeah, just like read, I definitely read his name frequently.
But did Margie Brown teach it?
No, not necessarily. Actually, no one really at Evergreen taught McLuhan, which I thought was interesting. After I graduated, I was thinking about that. But, I'd read the title of his books before and all that. But I'd never actually read anything by him until I saw Jerry speak, and then
Jerry introduced you to the concepts.
Yeah.
Oh, did you attend Jerry's meetings, or how did that happen?
At the Pixel Vision Film Festival, he speaks beforehand, and he was talking about McLuhan and James Joyce, if I remember correctly, and then I went out and I got The Medium is the Message, and then I read. After that, the Gutenberg Galaxy, and then some other ones too.
Well, that's a hard book to read. So you read through a Gutenberg Galaxy?
Yeah, definitely.
Oh, good. That would be at Craig Baldwin's theater.
Yeah.
In San Francisco.
Other cinema. Yeah.
What?
At Other Cinema or
ADA? Yeah, Other Cinema. That's Craig Baldwin's place in San Francisco, Scott.
Oh, yeah. So that's, is that where you hooked up with Jerry, or have you met Jerry in Venice where he lives?
No, actually, when I was in Olympia, I was shooting a Pixel Vision movie, and I called him up. I found his number online and just called it one night. And he answered, and he was nice, you know. He's like, "Yeah, send me a movie, put it in the festival." And then, so once I got a movie in, then I went and saw it when I was in. I happened to be in California when it was coming through,
and that's 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah.
So you hadn't attended Jerry's McLuhan / Finnegan's Wake reading groups or anything like that.
No, definitely not. But I'd like to.
And where, when Jerry handed you the material, the film, the Pixel stuff for you to edit, was that in San Francisco, or did you meet him in L.A.?
Bob actually handed it to me in
May, Scott. You were there in L.A. in May with me, and one day James drove me over to Santa Monica, over the beach or something, and I met with Will and Morgan was her name?
Yeah, Morgan and John Clark.
Right. And we talked for about an hour or two. We had a good talk, and I explained myself to them and filled them in and gave them what the footage that Jerry had given me. Because Jerry had already gone up to San Francisco or something. He had left town.
Yeah, he was in San Francisco during the Pixel Vision Film Festival.
Yeah, and you were down in L.A.?
When you handed it to Will, Bob, was it on an audio cassette or had it been transferred to video?
It was on a VHS.
It was on VHS, but it had been shot with a Pixel camera.
Yeah. Right? You can run a line from the camera into a VCR and shoot onto VHS tape.
So, that explains a lot. I mean, you were handed the material from... You know, you touched Bob's energy when he handed you that thing, and so there was a seed of information that was being communicated there that probably blossomed into you're doing more with the project than it had you not met Bob and just maybe Jerry had given it to you.
Yeah, that's true. Like you know, you get an extra hit from me in your subconscious when you meet me. That Scott is. Been documenting that for years on people, but yeah, and we talked. Remember, I discussed the four offices, the chart, or something, didn't I? I was running through the whole thing with you.
Yeah.
But you had not. I wasn't talking about the chart per se because you weren't even interested in the chart. Didn't even know about it really. I just was running through the different interests that I was identified with. Right? We probably talked about LaRouche, McLuhan, and I just went through the dynamics of Quadrophenia probably.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah,
and you're talking about presidents and post-information society and all that.
Yeah, and
I just found the video that I shot that day, and I'm gonna put it online soon. So.
Oh, great! Yeah, Scott, he taped it.
Oh, cool.
Yeah,
the audio is horrible, but because the wind's blowing on the microphone the whole time.
Oh, so we can't really hear what we're saying?
You can, but you have to try.
Okay, but it's atmospheric. It's like the gusty, it's like Wyndham Lewis used to say, or he wrote somewhere, the tragic gusts of history. That's what it was, the tragic gusts of history.
Wait a minute, Bob. You and I and, what's her face?
Robin
were on the beach with the guy who did the DEFCON, Bob.
Yeah, Eli.
We had the same problem with the wind, so that was interesting.
Yeah, the beach is a horrible place for audio, I think.
Right. But it was a good conversation, and I think there were some interesting points came up. I don't know, you know, there was some meeting of mind or something there with John and Morgan, the three of us, right? We got into something interesting. I don't remember what it was, but it's great. So you're going to put that up on YouTube?
Yeah.
Great, that'll be great. And more footies. We need all the footies of me we can get. Interacting with human beings, right? So go ahead, Scott.
Well, you know, very few people that I know that are into that have met Bob and have become enamored with Bob on some level or another have really taken a serious interest in studying the chart because Most people's pattern recognition skills are such that when they look at all the data on there, I think there's 322 elements. They just can't make
chart. Yeah, on my chart.
Yeah, they just can't really make any sense of it, and it's a huge amount. It takes a huge effort to actually begin to penetrate the layers of the chart, get some insight into it, and so you know, I congratulate you on being one of the few people I've met who actually, when he saw the chart, decided that it was worth tackling or taking an interest in. What did you feel that the chart was something you wanted to learn to understand, or did you feel that it just provided you with material in terms of the elements that you could put into your video? As I, you know, when I first saw your video, I didn't get it until I knew it was good. I thought it was one of the best things that I'd seen anybody do on Bob. And then when I talked to Bob about it and looked at it again, I realized that you literally lifted imagery from the four quadrants. And
yeah, let me just interrupt. We did this last week, I think, after our the first interview, Will, is I what you and I did, where you showed me the images and I highlight you so I could see them. I did that to Scott, and he started to catch a few. Oh, Jesus, stuff from the chart.
Yeah.
Even though he thought it was a good YouTube for some pixel for some reason, even though he didn't know the chart was in it.
And I thought it was a stroke of genius, because I've been trying to figure out for years how to elucidate the chart on the Internet, and I thought, God, what's it going to take to explain all of this? And you decided to take a, you know, because of your background in the film and video making and so on, you saw a way to do it. You have Bob's narration, and then you're just flashing these images, and it goes right into the subconscious, and it doesn't really need to be explicitly explained, but it's a. But I think what you've created is a virus that, when people see it, it's going to affect them subconsciously, and it's going to align them with the sort of Bob vibe, whether they know it or not, and may even in the future evoke new people into the Club 22, or just cause people to have their own little insights, synchronicities, and realizations, not even realizing that they've been sort of infected by something that they saw and maybe didn't even think about when they saw it. But I think you've done something really significant there. But what I want to know, what your what did you when you saw the chart, was it really, was this, did, were you intrigued to want to know how the levels sort of relate to one another, or did you just see it as source material for your video?
Oh, no, the video was in a way, me trying to understand the chart, I would say, kind of like working through it.
Yeah, you've made it visible so you could think about it.
Yeah, and like the whole time that I was working on it, it's kind of like making more and more sense. I spent like a couple months just, you know, analyzing the chart. I put it up at work on the wall. I kept the copy in my pocket, and I'd look at it. I'd show it to other people, you know, kind of that sort of thing. I started forwarding it to people at work along with like business emails just as an attachment.
Good. What do you think of that, Scott?
Oh, that's great. The I was just thinking about the fact that, like, the Tarot was developed out of the elements of the Hebrew alphabet, which connect the paths of the Sephira in the Kabbalah. But it was a visual way of talking to the subconscious. That's why they did it in pictorial form. I'm more of an acoustic person. I tend to learn through hearing, through listening, and through talking, and so I wouldn't have necessarily. You apparently are maybe a little more of a visual type person, and that's why you put this together the way that you did. Would does that make any sense to you, Will?
Yeah, that does make sense to me. I would say I probably am more visual. like, yeah, I don't play any instruments.
Yeah, Scott plays. Scott can play instruments.
Yeah. Did you? But you were tackling the chart. You didn't have you hadn't been exposed yet to William Irwin Thompson or to Croker. So did you do? Did you like Google these people? Or
I Googled everyone. I read about them. I read one by Croker, Nietzsche, Marx.
Yeah, the Will to Technology.
Yeah, Will to Technology. I read that to try and understand them. And, you know, before I read that, I didn't understand, or I didn't really know how well you captured his writing with your miming of him.
Yeah, panic music, panic stuff, all that I said, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's great.
So that's a quality that I admire. See, it further speaks to the notion that you're a visual person, because McLuhan categorizes the phonetic alphabet as being a visual medium, and so, you know, the fact that you can pick up these rather heavy books and read them and, you know, sort of penetrate through to what they're attempting to communicate. I on the other hand, tend to read as little as possible. I hate to admit it, but I think it probably goes along with being more of an acoustic person and less of a visual person. But so were you beginning, as you were studying Croker and the Thompson, and you already knew about McLuhan and you knew about LaRouche, were you getting any like gestalts, or were you trying to figure out how they relate to each other? Was there puns going on in your mind, or interconnectedness, like on those levels?
It seems to make sense how they all connected. At one point, I was thinking of using, instead of like all the montage constantly, I was thinking of using static shots of kind of like what they represent in terms of the chart to me. Like for LaRouche, I was going to use industry, like down in the docks in West Oakland.
Yeah, that'd be accurate.
And then, computer servers at my work for Croker.
What would you use for McLuhan?
For McLuhan, what was I going to use for McLuhan?
You could use TV.
Yeah, I think I was going to shoot TV. And then for you, I was going to shoot video feedback.
What's that? You mean distortion? Like Namjoon Paik and McLuhan?
Not distortion. When you turn a camera at TV, right?
Oh, you get the fractals. You get the fractal thing. Yeah. That's good. I even mentioned that in my essay on McLuhan. I talk about that. But anyways, back to what would you use for Thompson?
Oh, I was going to use nature. You know?
Yeah.
But kind of felt that wasn't a deep enough understanding of anyone to do that. Necessarily.
Yeah, that would be too cliche in a way.
Yeah, kind of.
It would fit, but...
And there's going to be montage over it, but there's going to be these, like, static shots.
Yeah.
But, still good.
Okay, Scott, carry on.
Well, I don't know that I have a lot more. I just... Congratulations on seeing that there was something worth going into and penetrating into the values of the chart and putting this together for yourself. I think that's really terrific. What is it that you do? I do have two more questions. What is it that you do for work?
Oh, I'm an assistant, or like an apprentice editor, video or movie editor.
Oh yeah. Oh, that's right. Now I remember last week you studied literature in school, so you've always been an avid reader. You consume, you're able to consume the written word I guess rather easily.
Right, but now he's in film editing.
Yeah.
Film editing. Yeah.
Yeah, I know, but you have that background in literature, which probably those two things go together well. Are there philosophers that you've read that you just can't penetrate? They're just like maybe Baudrillard or somebody that's just a little bit too out there for you to grasp. Have you come across that?
Yeah, definitely. Baudrillard, I mean, I like him from what I've read of him, but the Frankfurt School guy.
Or Adorno.
Yeah, Adorno, man. Adorno's pretty tricky, I'd say.
Have you read Ben Watson's book on Zappa?
No.
You got to read that. He's an expert on Adorno, and he applies Adorno to Zappa. And he does that in his follow-up book. He actually has done two books on Zappa. People don't realize that the second book, a few years after Frank Zappa, The Negative Dialectics of Poodle Play, that comes out in 93 about. In 98, he does a book, Art, Class, and Cleavage. And he carries on with the Adorno thing, which, you know, 90% of the Zappa fans thought was outrageous to even put Zappa through the Adorno filter. But it's really interesting what Ben did, and he makes Adorno understandable. He quotes him.
Yeah, I mean, I can read other people's interpretations of Adorno.
Yeah.
You know, like, I can do that, and people talk about him, it makes sense, but, like, reading his actual writing, just all the language, like, he uses words for many languages.
Yeah.
Some without the Roman alphabet, even. So.
Yeah. Now, did you read Derrida?
No, I haven't really read any Derrida.
Okay. He's probably pretty hard to read. What about Deleuze and Guattari?
No, definitely not.
Okay, so you've done Baudrillard, and then there's Virilio. Now, there's a guy I think you'd like. Virilio.
Really?
Yeah, Virilio is an ex-priest or an activist priest or something. That's V-I-R-I-L-I-O. I think it's only one L. And talk about disasters. You, as an anthropologist of disaster, he has now got funding. He's making the Museum of Accidents. He maintains that every new technological invention environment will create an amazing accident. And 911 proved him. You know, the whole digital world led to 911, and so he became even more respectable because of 911, because that was, a cosmic disaster, which fit into the thing he'd been writing about for 20 or more years. So, definitely, I hadn't thought of that. You, as anthropologist of disaster, got to find out about your mentor, Paul Virilio. Yeah, and his books are great. Very informative and easy, not too hard to understand. But that's why you see each person, LaRouche, McLuhan, Thompson, Coker, myself, are encyclopedists. They all have, like, their own holy offices. Like, Thompson had Ralph Abraham, James Love, who's the guy who created the Gaia hypothesis, James Lovelock or Love something. Lynn Margulis, all the sort of Gaia philosophers, Gaia scientists, and Francesco Varela. Who's the guy who did Gaia? James Lovelock?
Lovelock, yeah.
Lovelock, right, yeah. Okay, so he writes, you know, bounces off of those guys. McLuhan had Pound, you know, Ezra Pound, T.S. Eliot, James Joyce, Wyndham Lewis, Yeats, Moholy Nagy, the filmmaker. You ever read Moholy Nagy's book, Vision in Motion? You ever heard of that?
No, Vision in Motion.
Yeah, it's Moholy, M-O-H-O-L-Y hyphen N-A-G-Y, but he's Polish or something, so you pronounce it Moholy Nagy. His Vision in Motion, he analyzes Finnegan's Wake. I don't know if he corresponded with Joyce, but he was a big influence on McLuhan. And he's one of the artists who moved from painting into cinema, multimedia stuff. So McLuhan had his holy offices that he always bounced off of, and LaRouche has his holy offices. Of course, Plato, St. Augustine, Shakespeare, but who's someone in the Renaissance? Not Francis Bacon, but Kepler. Kepler and Leibniz, then Riemann of the 19th century, and then himself. All of them use themselves also. Themselves as a holy office. But so LaRouche had his core guys, and you know his literature, Scott. He's always going back and filling out those guys, right?
Right.
And McLuhan did that with his. Thompson does it with his. Croakers are, especially in the world of technology, but he'd written about them for decades, are Nietzsche, Heidegger, and Marx. Those are his holy offices. Plus, he's an expert on the Pombo guys, Baudrillard, Deleuze, and Guattari, Lyotard, Barthes, and whoever else I left out. So they are all encyclopedists rotating themes from being well-read and having original takes on their holy offices. Then I come in and subsume all of it, and they're my holy offices plus their sub-holy offices. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You know, it's like, what is that, that metaphor of the nests, the Chinese doll nests within nests, or Chinese dolls within dolls? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Right.
The Russian dolls.
Yeah, yeah. And so we're all encyclopedists. And then I point out that the Android meme is an encyclopedic itself. It has its holy offices. What are the holy offices? Radio, movies, television, computers and satellites, and maybe books and magazines. All those media on the charts are what the Android meme seamlessly replays and merges and converges. Synesthetically and co-anesthetically, to you quote Don Thiel, so the chart is the Android meme replaying LaRouche, McLuhan, Thompson, Croker, and Dobbs's mind, in the sense of the rotating memes and themes. Its memes and themes are whole media environments themselves. So you following this?
Yeah.
Now the chart. It's amazing. Nobody gets the chart. I mean, I've tried to make it. I thought the chart would help people. It doesn't do anything. It's rude. It's totally a failure, you know. Nobody gets anything.
It took me a while to realize that there's, like, even patterns within it.
Yes.
I think it was when I noticed, that McLuhan, LaRouche, and all that were in it, and then I started to see that, these are base, you know, or sports guys.
Yes.
These are Do, Re, Mi, Fa, Sol, La, etc., and all that stuff. And then it all started to make sense once I realized that there's a pattern within it. But there's nothing obviously suggesting the pattern.
Yeah, I guess I'm relying... Those names are not familiar at all anymore to young kids. Like, they don't know who Gordie Hall is, Gordie Howe, or Mickey Mantle. But if you're older...
I mean, I know Mickey Mantle, but I was never into sports myself.
Right, so you wouldn't know who Gordie Howe was then.
Right.
Right.
But luckily, I was with my friend who did know.
Well, yeah, it could be a group could analyze it. A group mind.
Yeah, when I was trying to figure it out, right before I started making like my last stab at it, which was probably the most successful. I was looking at it with my friend Sigurd Frey, and he'd been fasting for a few months, anticipating going down to Peru to do, like, ayahuasca for about a month.
Yeah.
So I don't know what that, it's kind of mystical and all that, but he's definitely in, just from fasting, his perceptions were altered probably more than my own.
By the...
And then he looked
at the chart.
Yeah, we were looking at it together, and it started to make more sense, which is why he's in the credits at the end.
Ah, what's his name?
Sigurd Frey.
Oh, okay. So he, because he was in an altered mind, he was more sensitive to how to connect parts of it.
Possibly.
Yeah, it's all pretty mechanical. You got the sports aspects. I'm showing all the activities in our information environment. You got scientists, athletes.
Like, once I realized what it was, I felt silly for not getting it. You know?
Yeah.
It's definitely all there. But
you know, maybe I should make a new chart with people who are known today for younger people. You know what I mean? Like an update. Just work with the same themes but put recognizable names in.
I don't know if that's necessary. You could put... You could put category names. I'd be interested just to see what you call each category, actually.
Okay, well, the categories are the radio effect, the TV effect, the computer effect, and the satellite effect, and then the post, I guess, the Android meme effect.
Like the subcat, like you have, like, Aunt B. I'm not looking at it in front of me.
Right.
But, you know, like that. Did you work on it like the Tetrad?
Yeah, all of that, it's the Android meme is a flowing tetrad. You know, things are enhanced. When you enhance the McLuhan quadrant, you look at the ratios on the far right, and you see all the senses are in ratio to tactility. None of the other quadrants have tactile in them unless you look at Croker, and his is tactile squared, meaning the Android meme replays human tactility in itself. But the ratios, if you're those hard-bitten, mean LaRouche kids, you are, let me just check this, I'm going to bring it up. You are an oral person, but you're emphasizing the visual. You're just learning to be literate. McLuhan used to talk about how the semi-literate and the non-literate or illiterate, when they first encounter books, they're fanatic about book rules and grammar because they think they have to be totally precise. They're totally within the literal imprint of the book effect, and they mime it. Whereas the more someone who actually could write books and is super literate, they aren't as impressed with the book. They're not hypnotized by it. They can play with it. And McLuhan's definition of imagination is that faculty that's not embedded in any sense or its extension. So a writer becomes a writer because he learns how to be playful with the language and break the rules. But when he was a kid, he learned the rules, learned how to read and write properly, right? So on a mass level, the working classes, from 1840 to 1900, were just becoming literate. Mass education, public education was coming in, and they were just thought it was so great that they could learn to read, having no clue that the best writers, the best poets for 200 years, like Alexander Pope, were talking about the services and disservices of literacy. These people didn't know that. They just knew that if they got literate, they could get out of their grime or poverty, right? So that's 1840 to 1900. The oral, semi-literate person wants to become visual. So if you look at the, pull out the chart here, and the ratio in the LaRouche quadrant is it's visual and kinetic as figure over the osmic acoustic as ground. So the ground is what they were created as they were young and what their basic environmental shaping was. So osmic acoustic people, if they start trying to be visual and they're American, they will be visual and kinetic. Kinetic means working with their hands and inventing gadgets. So the whole mechanical, the gadget lover, garage mechanic inventor archetype, or stereotype of American culture like Edison, those people. That is the meme of 1840-1900, and it's replayed in 47 to 57 when TV comes in, and TV is a software medium that threatens the identity of the visual kinetic over osmic acoustic. Okay? And then you look in the McLuhan quadrant, what are the sensory dynamics ratio there? It's visual, acoustic, kinetic, and osmic. A lot more senses as figure, because that's the sensory hedonism of the 60s when TV came in. And it's over the ground, which is proprioceptive and tactile. And proprioceptive is my word for, and McLuhan's word for, inner tripping. You inner trip when you watch TV. And it's a tactile medium. It is not osmic and acoustic like the industrial phase of 1840 to 1900, which is replayed by the radio. So the LaRouche quadrant, LaRouche's newspaper is a verbalization and print typographic replay of the radio effect. So the whole LaRouche quadrant is all the inventory of aspects of the radio meme, which is an afterimage by the 90s, okay? And then the McLuhan is the afterimage of the TV, or the McLuhan quadrant represents the constituents of TV and then as an afterimage. Now you get to Thompson. Now Thompson is a highly literate person who goes into the romantic phase of being, you know, overworked with the books and tired of books, almost like what you did, and starts slumming it, hanging out with the acoustic people. Maybe going to Peru and taking ayahuasca. hanging out with Native Americans. That's the Thompson effect, and the computer caused that, according to my scenario, in the late 60s. We won't go into why, that's more talk. But if you look at the sensory ratios of Thompson, he's acoustic, kinetic, and osmic as figure, and proprioceptive and visual as ground. Because the computer, like television, is electronic medium, it is proprioceptive and inner tripping. Now, television was proprioceptive as tactile, but the computer, back in the mainframe days, was proprioceptive and visual with the tapes, okay? And the figure in relation to that is trying to be acoustic, kinetic, and osmic. Like the hippies tried to develop their sense of smell by stinking, not washing. Okay? So here is Bruce, the opposite of Thompson. He is in the radio environment, therefore an all-electric media or tactile, but he is emphasizing the visual, acoustic, kinetic, and osmic. LaRouche is emphasizing visual and kinetic, suppressing the osmic and acoustic. That's why working people, or that middle class, working class culture, they don't like smelly people. Though other classes think they smell, they're into cleanliness. They're trying to be visual, make it nice and smooth and shiny. Think of the working class, the mother, you know, cleaning the house all the time. But Thompson, he's trying to be messy, acoustic and kinetic and osmic. Now, Thompson wrote books, but mainly he was proud of the way he could rant. He was famous for the lectures he could just improvise, but it was a lot of visual book knowledge in the content of his rant. LaRouche considers ranting as even jazz as inferior music compared to classical music. Classical music is based on the visual and the acoustic. And the kinetic, because Beethoven that provided the soundtrack for the development of industry after the Enlightenment. So you have here, looking at Thompson, he's acoustic, kinetic, and osmic, but he's really down deep, proprioceptive and visual, just as LaRouche is down deep, osmic, and acoustic, but trying to be visual, and Thompson's trying to be acoustic. Okay, I won't go on any longer, but that's how you look at what the whole thing is intertwined with. Okay?
Yeah.
Okay, Scott, say something.
Okay. Did you say you're an apprentice film editor?
Yeah.
What sort of organization or company do you work for?
DreamWorks, PDI DreamWorks.
Oh, good for you. That must be exciting.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, so that explains something to me, because when I saw how you gathered all the data together, all the imagery together to fill out the data of the chart, I thought, my God, how does somebody go about tracking down all those images? But because of your work in the industry, there's probably all kinds of tricks and techniques and archives that are available to you that wouldn't be available to somebody that was just trying to rip stuff off of the Internet, I suppose.
Actually, all of that's from the Internet, yeah.
Mm.
It's all from kind of weird places,
mm-hmm.
But it's definitely, I think almost all of it's from the Internet.
Mm.
And then it was put onto the VHS tapes, and then re-photographed off of a TV screen, is how it gets that quality.
Mm-hmm.
And there are toggle controls on the VHS tapes, so that it can control the speed.
Right.
It's manipulated, but it's all definitely all from the information superhighway, which I was thinking was kind of fitting as far as the Android meme goes and all that, because I always considered the Internet kind of the epitome thereof, but I don't know how spot on that was necessarily.
Yeah.
Scott, you actually misinterpreted him, but you also know he was skilled and he knew how to use the Internet.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
You're editing. Are you using like Avid or what high-end editing equipment?
No, Final Cut Pro.
Yeah, which you can just carry around probably on your laptop, I imagine.
What's that?
Is that like on your laptop or on a high speed?
Yeah. Definitely on a laptop.
Are you talking about at his work, Scott? What does he use? Asking what he works as.
No, what did he use specifically to make this video?
I used a G4 Apple laptop.
Uh-huh.
Like, not one of the Intel ones.
Right.
And then I also used a newer Apple at one point.
Yeah. Do you...
Scott, let me just throw this. So DreamWorks, you work at DreamWorks, and these charts are based on Finnegan's Wake, which is about dreaming awake. So DreamWorks, it fits. Employee...
And also, as far as Finnegan's Wake goes, when I was in high school, I mentioned last time that I took 10 years of English. Most of those classes were taught by a man, Dan Doyle, who was extremely into Finnegan's Wake and Ulysses, and would refer to them constantly, kind of like as the epitome of a book, you know?
Wow, that's amazing. So you had the Bob preparation right there.
Yeah, and I was kind of taught to like respect and fear it, you know?
Yeah.
Like, it was the final stage.
Yeah, the final phase for literature, or for writing mentality. Have you ever read my long interview about it with Jerry? The Ten Thunders?
I've read... Yeah, possibly.
Yeah, that's...
A bunch of your stuff.
I'm trying to get rid of your fear of it with that interview.
Maybe I haven't read that one.
Yeah, check it out.
You never wrote about Naked Lunch at all, did you?
No, but I've often posted McLuhan's review of Naked Lunch, which is really amazing.
I have to see that.
Okay, I'll send that to you.
Yeah.
No, I never said anything about Naked Lunch. Okay, Scott, back to you.
Have you been experiencing, or have you always experienced a lot of weird media synchronicity, or what Bob refers to as anachrony?
Yeah, I'd say so. When he's talking about it, it kind of rang true to my life.
Uh-huh.
I think from an early age, I started spotting synchronicities.
Right.
And all that, to the point where it wasn't even something to think about necessarily.
Right. Did it ever cause you to question the causality of that we, you know, we're, if you study the sciences, we're pretty well conditioned to believe that about cause and effect and linearity of time sequences, but then when some of these synchronicities occur, it causes me anyway to question that paradigm. Have you thought about that much?
You know, I mean, maybe a bit. It's never... never really seemed that weird, the whole synchronicity thing. Like, a friend of mine was talking to me about it, someone who's really into the subgenius, actually. He was saying that there's, like, ripples. Think about time as, like, as a pond, and then sometimes there's a rock that's thrown in, and then the ripples are sent back. And the rock might be thrown in the future, mm-hmm. and the ripples kind of hit you later on, or earlier on. I don't know if that answers your question.
Oh, yeah, but that implies that the future already exists and that it's reflecting back into the past, and the past is reflecting into the future. And
right, right. So not as linear, right? Yeah.
When you anchored on the fact that you noticed, you said that you had a little epiphany when you noticed the do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, that there were, I guess, stages or levels to the chart. Was there anything particular about the music, that the musical scale is in there, that struck your attention, or?
No, not necessarily. Like, I thought that was interesting, but probably due to my lack of musical education. In some ways, I overlooked that and looked towards other things instead.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I almost put representations of them in there, like. Thinking back to, like, the doe, a deer, female deer, bitch, and then just decided against that, so it's kind of campy.
Yeah. I thought about another way. Did you know about the other chart? The Dobbs formula chart? Did you ever look at that?
Yeah, I'd seen those, the other charts before, but I hadn't really paid as much attention to them.
Right, because this Tiny Note chart comes out of the Dobbs formula chart. The Dobbs formula chart is a bigger sort of
right.
expanse. But if you look in the Dobbs formula, on the left is ALP, far left column, and on the far right is HCE, and the three columns in the middle are the two sons and the daughter. Now, the Tiny Note chart replays that. And so the ground is the homeopathic television satellite, et cetera, on the left, under that would be the ALP, which is the female figure in Fitting's Way. Then the right, with the sensory ratios, is the HCE, or the male column. And the three columns in between are symptoms ripples from the two outer columns, the left and the right. So all across each quadrant, there's this rippling resonances of that era. You know what I mean? So the sensory ratios on the right-hand column are important, and how the endormeme replays those sensory ratios by each particular medium. And each one is in satellite because it's inside the global theater. So I just want your question, you know, like 15 minutes ago, was what is some major themes, I think, about the chart?
My question?
Yeah, that got me going into the sensory ratios. I think you said.
I was thinking, like, if you put, like, the formula for the chart, like, I'd be interested to see the formula. Just, like, what you call each subsection.
So I've been doing that a bit, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
But, like, to see the actual, like, one subsection would be, like, guys, another one would be particle, another one would be,
and they would be
forth.
Yeah, I'm saying that in the Android meme, a newspaper, Lynn LaRouche,
yeah.
The movie,
can I get all?
No, but
yeah.
the movie Catch 22, Nominalism, Lung Cancer, Patsy Cline, all those are basically subatomic particles within the merry-go-round, the cyclotron,
right,
of the Android meme. So they're all at the hadron level, which was an earlier particle. Then the meson comes later. And then the categories above, Rai, Eloy, Tu, Lofty, Bob, they are each strip of five categories is what each the everything is. So really we're looking at five holy offices, which are the prokaryotic cells, the anaerobic bacteria, the cyanobacteria, the eukaryotic cells, and the Akasha. Or the black hole, the red giant, the white dwarf, the quasar, the pulsar. Or the molecule, proton, electron, neuron, atom. It's like taking all these general themes of different specialist fields of knowledge and saying they're all interchangeable.
Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah, and I try to put everything in there.
Yeah.
And that's why it's a mini Finnegan's Wake. I've got every kind of basic meme of knowledge in there. I've got sport. I've got nature categories, I've got astral body categories, I've got popular slogans like God is dead or if it feels good, do it. I've got major figures, I've got different kinds of government, world government, solar government, interplaying cultures, Egypt versus Paris. You see the jazz and Elvis Beatles, Kennedy assassination, different kinds of scandals. It was like putting everything in there, which is what the internet is. It has everything. And it ends up what you've shown, you know, a dull blur out when you want to run to Peru and take ayahuasca, you know.
I got a question.
You said definitely?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Okay.
I got a question for you, Bob. I don't know enough about it to really go into the specifics, but recently I was looking at hierarchies and orders of angelic hosts during the visual space age, leading into manuscript and up to the printing press. The way that philosophers conceptualize these orders of probably sensory ratios and levels of beingness that are interpreted for a technological age or for a post-Android meme period in your chart, it was fascinating to me to see how detailed these orders of angels, archangelic hosts, and then the cherubim and the seraphim, and then all these other levels, many levels of angels and Davic forces, all of which were orders of beings that, that upheld certain structures I guess, physicality and of perception and of linkages between the world of Ra'i and the world of the essence. I'm wondering if those patterns have direct one-to-one correspondences with what you've laid out, but you've transformed them from angelic imagery into technological imagery.
And every other imagery. You see, part of this, since I say the android meme can't be seen, it's tactile, moves too fast, it's subatomic, it's just, it's like what Buzz Kosten makes in the YouTubes, you know, constant resonating imagery, flipping all over the place. So, if you take the android meme and it can't be seen, and then you try to see it, and you put it on a piece of paper and put it into the old technology of the alphabet, that is what I'm showing. I'm saying this is what the android meme would look like. But I'm showing the effect of writing and print. It categorizes, separates, and makes everything nice and tidy. What I'm actually trying to show is not nice and tidy. It's a Buzz Kosten Dobbs YouTube. But you're to realize that the paper makes everything appear separate. And these celestial hierarchies you're talking about, they were divided by eye people, writing cultures.
Mm-hmm.
All right? So they created these pyramids of separation and levels. McLuhan used to say that baby boomer students in the 50s and 60s, thought in levels and in stages and levels. He was saying that's 19th century thinking, but the kids were conditioned by that. They lived mythically. They lived tactile involved, but conceptually they thought like the 19th century because they were conditioned with literacy. So they thought in stages. So I'm actually satirizing the effort to put the android meme into stages. There's a certain level of a triple allele here. It's a trick.
Mm.
To say this is the android meme is ridiculous. The android meme is not. It includes all these contents, but it would not look evenly mapped out like this.
Yeah.
It would look like a Mobius strip times 10. And have you looked at Buzz Kosten's recent YouTubes? I mean, he's just layering the color and sounds, and it's a psychedelic mess, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's why people got into psychedelic drugs in the 60s as a mass effect or mass feeling, because they were living it inside the satellite environment.
Mm-hmm.
So part of the joke of the chart is if someone takes acid and tries to write down what they experienced, it looked like Finnegan's Wake. But I'm saying, no, if you fully understand the effects, you can admit that it doesn't look like this on paper, but if you could put it on paper, this is what it would contain. You following me, Will?
Yeah.
Which is nice that Will and Buzz are taking it off the paper and putting it onto the synesthetic montage on the cathode ray tube.
Yeah, like Will and what Buzz does are more accurate presentations because they have more media in them, more sound and imagery, and you can work with more extensions of the senses than a simple piece of paper, which is all this chart was when I used to hand it out to Jerry and them and you guys in the 90s. They are more accurately showing what I'm talking about on the radio shows than this chart does. But we do have a left hemisphere legacy, and we like to categorize things. And so this is what it is. It's saying, well, it would categorize like this, even though it would melt before our eyes if we get too involved in it.
Yeah. Well, the point, even when you study the chart, which is visual, the final epiphany is that all these stages that you've been studying all merge into one thing. But you had to break it up into stages before you could see how it all merges.
Right, and then the android meme then, with the internet, merges everything and then scatters everything so anybody can find any obscure piece of categorical knowledge that they want.
Right. You can grok the gestalt of the whole thing, or you can get lost in all the details.
Yeah.
But it's not but would you say, it's not fractal? You say it's anamorphic.
Anamorphic, which is see, the fractal to me shows the macro and the micro. It reflects it as above, so below. There's a visual framework, and you say, well, that's up there, and this is down here. We're a little world reflecting the God's world, or something. Even the idea that Rai returned to essence in the fractal concept or the micro-macro framework, the macro level of Rai returning to essence, which affects all of consciousness on a huge, unimaginable level, it's manifested on the micro level by the fact that television, as McLuhan said, with television the viewer becomes a screen. There's no separation. So no Rai separateness in the TV experience. So that's a fractal relationship, big and little. But once you get into the Android meme, it's going in all directions. It's like putting the TV camera on the TV monitor that Will mentioned, but it includes sound and includes movement and touch and all the senses. That mishmash is more anamorphic. It's more chaotic than the fractal. I mean, Dave Worster, his lecture too, we come full circle, his lecture... I have the transcript of his talk to the president of Evergreen College, and Reed and Lewis and Clark. And he talked about how recent science has shown that knowledge comes out of chaos. We've now come back full circle and live in chaos. And it's a multi-sensory chaos, not just a visual chaos. And anamorphic is a better term for the chaos than the fractal. Fractal looks pleasant and sort of looks a little disorienting, but there's a repeat factor. There's no repeat factor in the Android beam.
Yeah, but there's this foreground of knowledge and this hidden ground of embedded within the ground of chaos.
Hidden ground of chaos and a foreground of order and accessibility to anything. So all the on the accounting books level, all these Americans the last 20 years were making millions of dollars on the surface, orderly level. But the hidden ground of chaos, a virtual economy, meant that none of it was real.
Mm.
We now touch the chaos, and it evaporated, like Rai.
Yeah. And, Will, it seems like you were straddling the line there between chaos and order. Doing school and reading and keeping order about yourself, at the same time hanging out in disorderly, chaotic environments and doing school in a bit of a chaotic manner, not maybe as linear as a Harvard student would do it. So it seems like you were in the gap there, trying to stay in the gap. Would you agree with that? Yeah.
Yeah, I would say.
And you see that in the Safe Harbor stuff you sent me.
Yeah, Safe Harbor is definitely straddling the gap pretty hard, I'd say. In that, it's there is a form, there's a theme to every episode, even though it's not apparent to the viewer. There's a set of constraints.
Yeah,
that all the videos are made towards. Like one episode, it's like depending on what month you're born in, you get a certain color to dominate the visual. Every edit has to be 3 seconds apart or less, and repetition has to be systemic. You know, and so they're all kind of like made within a similar framework, but to the viewer it seems extremely chaotic, but really it's really rigid underneath all that.
And is that theory of the mid '90s came out of Europe? You know that film theory, that guy?
Maybe. Oh, no. It's no, it's not Dogma 95.
Right.
It's more along the lines of, like, poetry constraints.
Okay. So there you're putting a book mentality into this multi-sensory medium.
Right.
It's like doing it mathematically.
Yeah. Yeah, which, you know, is a big part of I'm Not Beer, too, because I was using, like, Eisenstein's montage theories.
You know, Eisenstein had a big effect on Joyce. Did you know that?
I believe it. Eisenstein amazing.
Yeah, and he wrote some of the... Joyce said, based on Eisenstein's writings interpreting Ulysses and Finney's Wake, he said, if Ulysses was going to be made into a movie, Joyce would demand that Eisenstein make it. Yeah. So the mathematical thing you're talking about, the chart has that. My chart is very mathematically organized on that level.
Right. Yeah. But it appears extremely chaotic.
Yeah.
You don't know what the formula is.
Yeah, isn't it funny? You look at it, you say, well, it's just a bunch of words and that's connected. But then eventually you say, oh, shit, it's all hockey players or sports players or magazine titles. And then it's all very grid-like, right?
Yeah, definitely. It kind of transforms instantly before your eyes.
Well, okay.
And if you know one of them, you can fill in the rest.
That's right. And so we come full circle. I wanted to stress more about Will's creativity and Safe Harbor TV, but it's come back that the mathematical thinking that went into Safe Harbor TV was able to find this mathematical thinking in my chart and then presented a mathematical replay of the chart in I'm Not Beer. You get that, Scott?
Yeah, that's great.
It fits.
Let me ask, Will, I was asking you about coincidence and synchronicity, and you know, I understand that you pretty much take it in stride because you've experienced enough of it. It's, you know, the wow factor has kind of gone out of it, but something's happened to me several times recently, which was kind of a stunning example for me. In fact, it happened last night. I was working on my computer, and some imagery came into my mind, and this morning I put a DVD in of a movie that I'd gotten in the mail through Blockbusters, and the movie's called Mind the Gap, oddly enough. And the imagery, the specific imagery that I had in my mind was in that film. And I'm wondering, as a film editor, do you have that experience of sort of almost like a precognitive thing about something, that some imagery in your mind, and then the next day you see it being played out in a film or something?
Not as much in a film as in real life, I'd say. Or else the other way around. See it in a film, and then it happens in real life. Something alludes to it. I just started watching Twin Peaks about a week ago after a couple of years. Since last time I watched it all the way through. And then today, you know, Bob mentions Twin Peaks. Stuff like that. That kind of happens more,
mm-hmm.
more than, yeah, than like thinking it, seeing a vision and then seeing it on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, if you get, you know, the Twin Peaks is, I don't know if you know that I claim it's about me. Have you ever heard me talk about that?
No, I've listened to your, the Inland Empire one. But,
right. Yeah, that's about explaining Lynch. But Twin Peaks, in the late 80s, early 90s, well, 90 when it came on.
Because it's all about Bob, right?
Yeah, but there was direct references to me and what I was doing that week in Toronto. Oh. That would be in the next episode. And Guffey was... Beg your pardon?
Oh, I was going to say that makes sense, as he's all into transcendental meditation and still continues to be into that.
Yeah.
He's kind of pulling his thoughts from a different area.
That's right.
Out of his head, necessarily.
Yes, and so Guffey was going to do an article eventually going into the synchronicities with me and Twin Peaks, and he never got that done. He became a teacher and other pressing things. He became a father, so he didn't do it. But I'm saying, if you're into Twin Peaks and if you dig the synchronicity we're getting, maybe you could do a film or something on this with me.
Yeah?
It. I'm open to talking to you about it. We'll give you ideas about it.
Yeah, there and Bob's not kidding. It really is about him.
That'd be pretty good.
Yeah.
Could you email me the? Are those talks recorded?
Yeah. Jerry. I'll see if I got it copied. Jerry may still have the tape. I'll have to work on that. Yes, and then Scott used to have a site called Zanocrony.com, and it had the some of Guffey's thoughts on Twin Peaks, right, Scott? Didn't it?
Yeah, I can dig that up and forward it on.
Yeah, so we'll try to dig this stuff out for you. And
great.
If you can't find the Lynch talks. I may have them on tape somewhere, so...
You may have got a copy from Jerry.
Yeah, if you are unable to get that figured out, let me know. I'll see what I can do about it.
Yeah, what happened in 1993, before I got to Jerry's and I stayed there for 6 months, he had a younger guy living there, and Jerry was getting the CKLN Toronto radio shows. He had the kid go through all the shows and find the parts where I talked about Twin Peaks, and he made one little cassette, one or two cassettes. They then, a week before I got there in February 93, went to a gallery opening with David Lynch and gave him the cassette.
Yeah, we should make a movie. We should get him involved too.
Yeah, we should call him up and say, did you do your homework? Did you listen to the tape? We've given you 15 years. Did you do it?
That sounds great.
Okay, good. Keep watching the Twin Peaks.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. Let me just take a... Okay, that's a break, Scott. I need to just... No, I can't. What I need to do is I need to call someone who I'm supposed to talk to soon. And I don't want to end this, but can we take a minute and let me see...
Actually, I have to... I kind of have to go, too. Could we continue, like, in 2 days or 3 days?
Oh, no, maybe in a week. But what we'll do, Okay. Well, we have a nice ending there where we're laughing about that. You'll do the Twin Peaks, you know, interest in Twin Peaks. Then we pause. Let's have that be the ending. Okay, Scott?
Okay.
Sure.
And then we'll get into, we'll keep talking.
Okay, let's do it at a, can we do it at 6 next time?
That would be 4, yeah, that's no problem.
Okay, excellent, yeah, next Monday at 6.
Okay, now I don't know if there's anything more to talk about this thing, but we should talk anyways, and not necessarily for public, but to get into whatever this is going to lead into.
Okay, cool.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
unless,
definitely.
Unless Scott has more to ask, I pretty well run the course here. We covered everything. Unless you want to do more on the chart. What's interesting, Scott wants to interview, we've got a lot of interview on the chart going into details of what it means. And we never did my quadrant. We've done all the other quadrants. Maybe we could do my quadrant with Will on the line.
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. So anyways, we better sign off right now. I'm going to call you back later, Scott. Let me just see what this person's doing. I want to get them before they go to bed.
Okay. And forward Will's email to me, and then I'll email Will, and he'll have my address.
Okay, good.
Excellent. Yeah.
So thanks a lot, Will. That was really good tonight.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, talk to you soon.
Bye.
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 Bye.